And now for something completely different.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Let's do it.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. With you till 3 on this Thursday with plenty to get to over the next few hours. Coming up, is there a path for Cincinnati to make the college football playoff? Plus, we'll continue to break down the game Saturday between Florida and South Carolina. A big spot for Dan Mullen with a chance to prove himself. Also, why it was good for baseball that the Atlanta Braves won the World Series this year. We'll talk about said World Series with James Wagner coming up later on this afternoon of the New York Times, who is there covering it live. And later on in the afternoon, now that the Braves have won, what other fan bases deserve a championship next? Who's the one quarterback that both Clemson and South Carolina should be targeting? Some thoughts on Aaron Rodgers. Get to our wrestling wrap-up. Some monkey business in college football, quite literally. And a whole lot more throughout the afternoon. We'll catch up with Paul Charchian next hour to talk about Week 9 of the NFL season. Help you set your fantasy football lineups. And Lee Sterling will join us at 2 o'clock to give us his football picks of the week. Coming off a perfect weekend with us last week. You can join the conversation throughout the afternoon, 843-721-9500 to give us a call. You can always text the show, 843-608-1734. Get to us on Twitter at Morrow Middays, on Facebook at ESPN Charleston, via email, studio@kirkmanbroadcasting.com, or online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Just click on our show page, and there you can leave a comment for the show. You can find the latest versions of the show podcasted right there, or you can even take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go by simply streaming us online at charlestonsportsradio.com. With you till 3 on this Thursday, Joe's on the steel wheels. Joe, what's going on? How are you?
Oh, what's going on? The only thing better than Friday Eve is Friday, so it's reason to look forward to tomorrow. How about you?
Yeah, not bad. We're getting there. And we had the coaches show last night for the Citadel. They play against Samford, so we got a busy weekend. Hit the road to Alabama, that game coming up on Saturday. Florida and South Carolina, we'll talk about that. Clemson and Louisville, we'll preview those games, of course, tomorrow and have the opponent scouting report.
Does that explain the ride you pulled up in today?
No, I've had that for a while. My car is being worked on, so I've been driving around a truck, and it's the first time I've ever driven a truck. Well, I guess technically the second time, but the first time that I have driven a truck, you know, as my vehicle. I was given a truck earlier this football season from Crew Chevy, who always provides us our vehicles to travel for Citadel football. And they gave me a truck for, that was the Coastal Carolina game. And that was really the first time that I spent much time behind the wheel of a truck, other than like maybe, you know, moving a friend's car or something from one spot to another. You know, that was the first time I actually drove on the highway and went somewhere in a truck. And now I've been driving this truck for a couple of weeks. It's been great. And, you know, I consider myself, now I feel like a bit of a truck person. And when I purchase my next car, maybe I'll look into getting a truck. Somebody the other day told me, they said, yeah, I saw you driving a truck. They said, you looked happy. You looked like a truck person. I said, yeah, I kind of feel like it. Maybe I am. I know Bobby said I'm becoming, you know, it's like a rite of passage. Bobby said I'm becoming more of a Southerner by the day now that I have a pickup truck that I'm driving around. So I'm fitting right in.
Is it a pickup truck or a pick-em-up truck?
Well, what's the difference? I don't know my trucks well enough. What's the difference?
A pick-em-up truck gets you all kinds of looks.
Oh.
See?
Yeah. So, anyways, yeah, it's been nice. But with that said, no, I'm going to have to swap it out now for another car for the weekend because Crew Chevy always helps us out. So we're driving all sorts of automobiles these days. It's kind of nice. You get to try out all these different cars. Appreciate Crew Chevy always helping us out. But, yes, we'll hit the road to Samford with that long trip. Get ready for that game coming up on Saturday. And then, by the way, it's a different time zone. Birmingham, Alabama, where Samford is located, is central time zone. And then what, we have to adjust the clocks, right? Saturday night going into Sunday. What are we doing? I always get confused. Do we set the clocks? Are we losing time or gaining time? I don't understand. They say spring forward and fall back, right? So does that mean are we falling? Are we moving the clock back? Are we losing an hour? I never understand this stuff. Thank goodness, you know, my phone updates itself. Otherwise, I would have no idea between the time change of the time zone and whatever we're doing with the clocks on Sunday. I would have no idea what time it is this weekend.
We're falling back, so therefore we gain an hour.
Oh, we're gaining an hour?
Yes.
Oh, nice. Okay. Well, that helps then. That helps with my travel as well, because I got quite the drive to and from Birmingham. And then plus the time zone. So I lose an hour at the time zone coming back central to Eastern, but then I get it back because we fall back. So then I guess it's a wash. So it's all good. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, let's see. You'll go into the central time zone.
Yeah.
Okay. So you'll kind of gain an hour that way.
Right. Which is
then
nice.
Then you'll lose it coming back. But then again, it's going to fall back.
Yeah.
So you're still going to gain an hour.
All right. So this works out for me. This is the good weekend to go to the central time zone. So anyways, get that all figured out. And, I got juggling cars, time zones. I don't know what's going on. Let's start with Cincinnati in the college football playoff. The rankings came out Tuesday. I gave you my initial thoughts yesterday. And, of course, when you look at these rankings, I think the biggest issues that people have with the rankings, twofold. Number one is that Alabama's number two. And it doesn't look great on paper when you put a one-loss Alabama ahead of an undefeated Michigan State or even an undefeated Cincinnati, or you have undefeated Oklahoma and Wake Forest at 8-9, but you have Alabama, who lost to, at the time, an unranked team, at number two. But for Alabama, they have three wins against top 20 teams. No one else can say that. And we do know, you know, the whole eye test thing, and they passed this test and that test, and Alabama number two. Yesterday I said, because I think the committee and Dave Bartu would probably rip apart all of my theories, who joined us on the show yesterday to break it down, and you can catch that on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. But my theory would be that you want to provide as much buffer room as you can. And if you put Alabama at two, depending on what else happens, maybe even with the second loss, you could still find a way to drop them only to four and get your first ever two-loss team into the playoff if that second loss is to Georgia, the number one team in the country. How far would a team realistically drop if they lose to the number one team in the country at a neutral site, especially if it's a close game? And Cincinnati, meanwhile, they're at number six behind Ohio State, who has a loss, Oregon, who has a loss, again, Alabama, who has a loss. Is there any path for Cincinnati to realistically make the playoff? I'll say this to begin. Since the playoff began, two-thirds of the teams in the initial ranking make the playoff field by year's end. There isn't a ton of change in the top four from this point on, historically, to the end of the season, which makes it more difficult for Cincinnati to have to try to leapfrog some teams. But when you look at the teams ahead of them, Ohio State and Michigan State have to play one another. Georgia, Alabama have to play one another. Right? Michigan, who's right behind Cincinnati, has to play still Ohio State. So the teams in front of you can cannibalize a little bit. They have to play one another. Someone's going to have to lose. And if you take care of business, if you're Cincinnati, you can strengthen your case. Doesn't mean that they would be put into the top four, but it gives them a better opportunity. But I think a clear message has been sent once again, and that is that the committee is not interested in any group of five. Now, in their defense, when you want to compare resumes, and as I always say, there's only so much you can do. You know, you win your games. What more do you want? And then people say, oh, Cincinnati, they don't play anybody that's good enough. So then they went out and they scheduled Notre Dame and Indiana on the road, and they beat them. And it's still Notre Dame's only loss. It's the only time Notre Dame has scored fewer than like 28 points, right? And Indiana, I know they haven't had the season that was anticipated this year, so we hold that against Cincinnati. They went out, they scheduled those teams, top 20 teams, to begin the year on the road, and then, well, yeah, sure, but, you know, Indiana's not very good this year. We keep moving the goalposts for said group of five school. But the committee, and also, by the way, Cincinnati does have the 100th strength of schedule, which is the worst of the top 10 teams. The teams that they have played this year have an overall combined losing record, so that doesn't bode well for them as they don't get to play an SEC schedule or a Big Ten schedule or even a Big 12 schedule. But the committee slotted Cincinnati at number six, putting them really in the friend zone. Right? You ever been in the friend zone with somebody? You try to get to know somebody of the opposite sex. You're interested in a girl in high school, and they put you in the friend zone. And they keep you close, but not close enough. Right, you're a friend, you want to be a little bit more. Cincinnati's number six, they're close, but not as close as they like to be. They're a friend, they'd like a little more. They'd like to be in the top four. But the committee's keeping them at an arm's length. Right, you do just enough to try to please, but but not enough where they're satisfied. You can hang out with her all the time, but it's not like you're going to get a kiss at the end of the night. Right, Cincinnati, they're the number six team. They're close on the outside looking in, but they're not going to get into the top four. And a clear message by the committee that, A, they're not interested in the group of five, and, B, if you are, if you want to see somebody like Cincinnati have a chance, then what you would need is either an expanded playoff or the group of five to go do their own thing, or in the case of Cincinnati, right, go to a bigger and better conference and find your path that way. RG3 was on ESPN's Get Up. Robert Griffin III, who now covers college football for ESPN, and he was breaking down the backhand that was handed to Cincinnati with the playoff rankings this week and his takeaways from the initial rankings.
You know, they always say never go full rant, but I might have to go full rant right here. Cincinnati not being in the top four is a clear sign from the committee that group of five schools have absolutely no chance to make the college football playoff in its current structure, right? No chance. Boys to men, end of the road type stuff here. And then the fact that Oklahoma is sitting there at number eight as a undefeated, if the season ended today, they'd be an undefeated Big 12 champion, which is a Power 5 conference, and they're at eight. Don't even get me started on Wake Forest being at number nine and the ACC being undefeated. And in the SEC, it's like this is not the SEC college football playoff, but there's seven SEC schools in the top 25. It's just very frustrating, and you're telling the Houstons, the Louisianas, the SMUs, the Cincinnatis of the world that not only are they not invited to the dinner table, they can't even park the cars out front. They might as well go ahead and get the process of changing this structure right away.
What do you think, Paul?
Well, it was a beautiful speech, Robert, but you have to remember something. This is the first of the polls, and things can change.
Yes, things can change. Paul Feinbaum at the end there with Robert Griffin III. But as I said off the top, two-thirds of the teams in the initial rankings are in the playoff field at year's end. So we usually don't get a ton of change. This year could be different because one and two will most likely play one another. Three and five will play one another. Three and seven, five and seven will still play one another. 8 and 11 will still have to play one another. 8 and 12 have to play one another, so on and so forth. There could be some movement in these rankings, but usually not enough of a change to make a significant difference by year's end. And Cincinnati will need a lot of help in order to make some sort of significant difference to get into the top four because there's teams behind them that could even leapfrog. I think the committee would rather have an undefeated Oklahoma and or Wake Forest before a group of five Cincinnati. The message continues to be sent to the group of five that they're not interested. Right? They're friend-zoned. Cincinnati, this is the highest we've seen a group of five rank. They get closer, but still not close enough. You feel like you're getting closer to that person, yeah, but she's still keeping it at arm's length. You're just friends, nothing more. She calls you when she has trouble or concerns with other guys. You want to be that other guy. Cincinnati won't have that opportunity to get into the top four. Not this year either, despite all the chaos in college football. Speaking of which, we'll get to Dan Mullen and the Gamecocks in Florida coming up Saturday. It's a big spot. We talked about it a little bit yesterday, but Mullen has a big opportunity here Saturday against the Gamecocks and the startling comparison in the recruiting rankings between those two. But when we come back, why the Atlanta Braves winning the World Series was a good thing for Major League Baseball. And we'll get to that next. It's the Mara Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
It's Throwback Thursday.
What's today?
It's Thursday.
Really? Feels like Tuesday.
Tuesday has no feel. Monday has a feel. Friday has a feel. Sunday has a feel.
I feel Tuesday and Wednesday.
All right, shut up, the both of you.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Coming up, why it was a good thing the Atlanta Braves won the World Series this year. And not just because you may be a Braves fan. It's the Mara Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Speaking of baseball, You can join us this Saturday for the Somerville Miracle League Annual All-Star Game. There'll be two games played at 10 a.m. and 11 a.m. over at the field located at 615 South Laurel Street in Somerville. And if you can't make it out in person, don't worry. You can hear it all right here on ESPN Radio this Saturday, starting at 10 a.m. The Somerville Miracle League, which is always a great thing. I was out there. In fact, you know what? It is a throwback Thursday. I think we still have some of the highlights from our game last year where people from the radio station play. Because of COVID, it had to be a little bit different last year. We couldn't have the actual Miracle League All-Stars. So we had people from here, the building, play against a car dealership. Right, Joe? You played in the game, right, last year?
Yes, I did. Yeah. It was Stokes Honda, I believe.
Okay. I should remember. I was on the broadcast. I think we still have some of the highlights in the system from that game last year. But this is going to be different. Now we can get back to a normal Miracle League All-Star game with the kids themselves out there playing. So either go out there and check it out. It's a really cool field, 615 South Laurel Street in Somerville. Or you can hear all the action on ESPN Radio right here Saturday morning starting at 10 a.m. Unfortunately, I can't be on the call this year because, you know, we didn't have Citadel football because of COVID. We do now. So I'll be in Alabama out of town. But Bobby will be handling things, as I understand. So that's a great thing. When I was in minor league baseball, we worked closely with the Miracle League down in Florida. And I'm nothing if not a name dropper. John Smoltz, as we'll get to the Braves in just a second, John Smoltz helped us out with that as well. He was very kind. Him and his mother-in-law were involved with us with our work with the Miracle League. And that was great. But it's a great great thing to be involved with. And when I came here, it was great to see that here at the station, involved with the Miracle League. So very cool. And that's going on Saturday. You can hear it here at 10 a.m. right here on ESPN Radio. Speaking of the Braves, of course, won the World Series two nights ago. We'll catch up with James Wagner in a little bit, who was there covering the World Series. He writes for the New York Times and had an interesting story last week about what may have been the missing piece for the Atlanta Braves in all this. We'll get to that with James coming up in about 10 minutes. But I think the Braves winning the World Series was a good thing for Major League Baseball. If Rob Manfred could pick at the World Series champion, well, you know, for Manfred, maybe you would pick the Astros to vindicate yourself because of the poor job you did punishing the Astros. And so if you're Manfred or Major League Baseball, you would love to sweep that scandal under the rug and be able to do so by saying, hey, they won a World Series anyways, right? It wasn't that big of a deal like what all the Astro defenders believe. But I'll come at it from a different way. I have three reasons why I think it was good that the Braves were the team that won the World Series this year. Number one, because, despite what I may have just said, the majority of the country was rooting against the Astros. In fact, 47 states out of 50 were polling for the Atlanta Braves. So, you know, good versus evil, the good guy wins. We always like when the good guy wins. You don't like to watch a movie and the bad guy wins in the end. You want to see the heroes emerge. That's the case for the Atlanta Braves. A lot of happy baseball fans in the country that got to see the Astros lose the World Series instead of the Braves. And the Braves, even if you're not a Braves fan, are kind of a feel-good story. It is a good fan base. It's been a long time coming since they've been able to celebrate a World Series. It's an easy team to get behind if you're just a neutral observer, especially when they're going up against the Astros. But more importantly, reasons number two and three why it was good that the Atlanta Braves won the World Series was because number two, they were aggressive at the trade deadline. And that sends a good message to the rest of the league. There's a reason why Rob Manfred wants to expand the playoff field in Major League Baseball, right? Because then more teams will be invested in the season. And when you have more teams interested, you have more cities invested, you have more fan bases who care, you can sell more tickets, get better TV ratings, because now they have a reason to watch in August and September. Instead of when their team is out of it and they become sellers at the trade deadline, and they pack up their bags, and that's it on this year. And once the team sends that message, then what is the reason for the fan to be invested? If the team doesn't care anymore, why should the fan base? Why should that city? And the Atlanta Braves are one of those teams that could easily have done that. I remember at the time talking about it, right? If you're the Braves, which way do you go? And I was kind of on the fence. I do remember saying, you know, just kind of get ready for next year. Get healthy, right? Just write this year off. Get ready for next year. But as they made those moves, I like the moves that they didn't take too big of a gamble. You don't want to make some big drastic move in vain, but they were aggressive enough that they didn't invest a ton of resources that if things didn't work out, they'd be doomed, but they also were making a run at it. And as it turned out, a much larger run than even I anticipated. But the message that the Braves sent to the rest of the league, because sports are such a copycat league that whenever we have a champion, everyone else will look at that champion and figure or try to figure out, how do they get there? What can we do? And the NFL, NBA, everything. You look at that champion, and if they did something a little bit different, they hired Sean McVay, even though the Rams didn't win the Super Bowl, but they got to the Super Bowl with Sean McVay, and it's like, oh, we need that young coach. We need that young offensive mind. Or Patrick Mahomes, right? When the Chiefs get to the Super Bowl, that exciting young quarterback, and you think, we need a young, exciting quarterback. And in Major League Baseball, for the Tampa Bay Rays, they get there, or even the Royals a few years ago with a small payroll and the use of analytics, and you think, we should do that. We don't have to spend a lot of money. We can just rely on analytics as well and piece it together. Or the Dodgers get there and spend a ton of money, and then you have the New York Mets go out and spend a ton of money afterwards thinking, that's what we have to do to keep up. And for the Braves, they were aggressive at the trade deadline despite being under 500. And it sends a message to the rest of the league that, hey, you're not out of it. If you are a 500 team or slightly below 500 or in third place at the end of July, if you make the right moves at the deadline, you too can turn your season around. Be aggressive. Go for it. And that would be the perfect message for Major League Baseball. That's what Rob Manfred would love. Teams to be aggressive. That even if they're under 500, they're still giving themselves a chance heading into August. They're still trying to make something happen. They go out and acquire players. They try to turn around the season. They don't pack it in. It would have been easy for the Braves to just say, yeah, that's it. Now, this year we lost Acuna. We don't have Soroka. We're under 500. Things aren't going well. Guys were slumping early. Let's pack it in, get ready for next year. But, of course, that's not what they did. They were aggressive, and it led to the ultimate prize. Other teams can see that, and now moving forward, when they're in a similar position, they say, hey, forget punting on this year. We just saw the Braves last year and the Nationals 2 years ago. Weren't the Nationals 19-31? It gives teams hope, despite early struggles, that they can still go win a World Series. It gives fan bases a reason to remain invested, that even if their team is in last place heading into June, it's like, you know what? We've seen this twice in the last 3 years where a team was under 500 for almost half the season and still turned out to be the best team in baseball by year's end. We don't need to give up on our team just yet. And the Braves, of all teams, know how hard it is to win a World Series because the Braves had so much talent in the 90s and only came away with one. They know how difficult it is. So at this trade deadline, the position they were in, they could have said, we're not winning this year. I mean, look at what's happened in the past. We've had far better teams that haven't won the World Series. You think we're going to win with this team? But again, none of that thought process. They went out and made moves to become the World Series champ, to become the best team in baseball. They completely reinvented their outfield, brought in four new outfielders, right, and changed things around. And when you look at past World Series champions, the Dodgers last year didn't add anybody because they didn't need to. They had a good roster. Plus, it was a quirky season, extra playoff teams, COVID. There just weren't as many trades a year ago. Teams were making less money, so they didn't want to take on more contracts. But you go back to previous years, 2019, the Nationals added three pitchers at the deadline, helped them go to win the World Series. 2018, the Red Sox added Nathan Eovaldi and Ian Kinsler, and Eovaldi was huge in that postseason, especially the World Series. The Astros in 2017, when they won, added more trash cans, but also Francisco Liriano. The Cubs in 2016 got Aroldis Chapman at the trade deadline, as well as two other pitchers. Right, the Royals in 2015 traded for Ben Zobrist and Johnny Cueto. The Giants and Red Sox, the two previous years, both traded for Jake Peavy at the midway point. The Giants in 2012 got Hunter Pence midseason. The Cardinals traded for five different players in 2011 when they won. The Giants traded for two pitchers in 2010 when they won. Point being, there's a trend there. The World Series champion usually does make some moves at the deadline, but never to the extent of the Atlanta Braves this year. And now that's the message it sends to the rest of the league. Be aggressive. Go for it. Don't count yourself out at the end of July. And that's good for the league because if you're Rob Manfred, your ideal situation is all 30 teams being interested, being invested until the very end. Fan bases into it, stadiums full until the end of September because all these teams are competing for potential playoff spots. It never happens that way, but that's always the hope that maybe not all 30, but close to have a rooting interest till the very end. Which takes me to my number three point for why it was good that the Braves won the World Series because along the same lines, we now have a new World Series champion. The Astros have been to the World Series three times in the last 5 years. They won one of the first two. They now lost this one. We've seen the Astros. We've seen the Dodgers. Even if they don't always win their trips to the World Series, we've seen those teams. The Dodgers have controlled the NL. The Astros have controlled the AL. And, historically, the Yankees, of course, the Red Sox. But you get the Braves, who have been a very successful franchise, but of course just won their first World Series in 26 years. And so you get a new World Series champion, their first World Series since 95, and as I shared on the show yesterday, Major League Baseball now has had 15 different World Series champions, 15 different teams win this century, going back to 2000. That's the highest number of unique champions of any of the four major sports. They've had 27 of 30 teams make it to at least a championship series, 21 of 30 teams make it to a World Series during that stretch, and that goes hand in hand with what I just said. My number two point about the trade deadline is that it gives everybody a reason to believe. It gives all fan bases hope. The Rays have been to a World Series multiple times during that stretch. The Royals have been to multiple World Series, right? It doesn't matter what market size. You don't have the best players in the league on your team. You don't sell out every night. You don't have the largest payroll. That's okay. Major League Baseball has actually had the most parity of any sport since 2000. And that's important, right? College football, people tune out in college football because it's the same teams every year. We talk about it all the time throughout the season, and it's one of the bigger issues for college football. It's becoming really a southeastern sport. In the Northeast, people don't care. Out West, people don't care about college football. They care more about the NFL because their teams aren't good enough. You don't care about the Pac-12. There's nobody in the Northeast of interest in college football. It's the Southeast and then up North with the Big Ten, a few states there with, you know, Ohio and Michigan. For baseball, when you can spread the champions throughout the country in different years, it's different teams and the Nationals one year and the Royals and the Rays and these unique teams that you're not used to seeing compete, then as we head into next season, right, more fan bases, teams, front offices believe they have a chance. Reasons two and three that I just laid out, those are reasons that give all fan bases a reason to care. It gives all front offices a reason to still care at the end of July. And as they say, a high tide rises all boats. It's the same idea. If you want all teams to be invested, all teams to go for it, all fan bases to still have a rooting interest, that's the best thing for the sport. I think the Braves showed some of that by winning the World Series this year after the hideous start they had. We'll talk more about the Braves' improbable run to the World Series when we come back. James Wagner of the New York Times will join us. He was there at the World Series covering it all and had an interesting article about the Braves last week and their turnaround. We'll talk with James next. It's the Morrow Midday Show here on ESPN Radio.
You're listening to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Holly came from Miami, FLA. It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Still in the afterglow of the Atlanta Braves World Series Championship, the first since 95. And joining us now to further break it down and talk about it is James Wagner, who was there covering it live for New York Times, covers baseball for the New York Times. Follow him on Twitter at @byjameswagner, and he's with us now. James, good afternoon. How are you?
Good, catch up on sleep after the last month of just going everywhere around the country to cover baseball. But yeah, it was an interesting series, and thanks for the intro song too. It's a heavily sampled song, so I like that song a lot.
Hey, good to hear. Glad you approve of your walk-up song. You know, you said it's been a while that you've been traveling, of course, for the playoffs. You were there covering this World Series. So before we dive into what actually happened on the field, take us into that moment, because 99% of us, the rest of us, you know, don't get to be there to cover a World Series. So for somebody who does, what is it like to be there when a team, and especially a team like this that, you know, so improbable this year, 26 years, what is it like to be there on site, even as somebody who's working as a team wins a World Series and celebrates?
I guess having, you know, last year's pandemic experience where, you know, the games were at a neutral site all throughout the playoffs, I guess, you know, this is my fifth or sixth time covering a World Series, so I don't necessarily, and it didn't really feel that different other than the fans. Like, I think that really stood out to me, seeing full stadiums again, people back in the stands. Just that energy that I was so missing and made last year feel so sterile. So, yeah, it just made the 2019 season, the last time the fans were in the stands again, feel like so long ago. So I think that really stood out to me, being around the ballparks again, feeling the energy, walking around downtown, heading to the stadium, people talking about it, that kind of, you know, that buzz that I did not feel at all last year in the neutral sites. So, yeah, I'd say, I don't know if you guys felt that the same way, but I think the energy and excitement and interest was so different this year.
Yeah, no, I do agree. I think it came through just watching on TV. It was so much different and better than the postseason last year, and it was great to have those full stadiums back this year and have the fans involved. Maybe I'm being a prisoner of the moment in all this with the Braves having just won, but can we put into context how improbable of a run this was? I know, at least according to FanGraphs, the Braves had less than a 1% chance to do this 3 months ago. They remade their outfield, you know, changed things on the fly. You lose Acuna during the season, Morton in the World Series. Can we try to put into context like how impressive of a run, how surprising of a run this was for the Braves to go from where they were in July to become World Series champions?
Sure. I mean, 10 teams made the playoffs. They had the fewest regular season wins of all of them with 88, and they didn't go above 500 until the first week of August, so after the trade deadline, after they acquired all those players. And I think, but from August on, like, the narrative had completely changed about that team, and I think maybe people had not caught on just yet, just because how drastic a turnaround it was. The first 4 months, you know, were rough for them. The last 2 months, August and September through the first week of October, right going into the postseason, the Braves were playing at 100-win pace. So if they had had that collection of players, playing the way they had the last 2+ months of the season, they would have more than 88 wins. But they were a product of their division two, which was so, you know, average and middling. They could tread water that long and still be in it until the trade deadline and not be over 500 until August because of the division they were in. And I mean, maybe there's something to be said about, you know, playing in a more competitive division where no one has run away with it, where you are forced to play kind of meaningful games up until the last weekend of the season. The season ended on Sunday. I think it was like October 4th. They didn't clinch the division until that Thursday. So they really only had those 3 last days where they didn't have to worry about the results of the games. They were playing every single day until it mattered. Unlike maybe, say, another division where, you know, it's pretty clear who's going to win it. You know, say the Brewers, that, you know, it's very clear they're going to win it by the beginning of September. So the last month of September, they really didn't really matter as much. So maybe there's something to be said about that, a team that's really pushed to the edge all year, kind of like the 2019 Washington Nationals, making it as a wild card team and then going from there.
Yeah, you mentioned the Nationals. I was just talking last segment that I think the Braves doing this is good for baseball because it sends a message to fan bases, to front offices, that you may never be out of it. You know, even if you are under 500 at the deadline, you could still go make moves to turn your team around. Maybe these two teams are just outliers in the last 3 years, the Nationals turning things around after that slow start, the Braves, who are under 500 till August. But would you agree with me that this is, you know, this could be a good message throughout baseball for front offices, fan bases to be more invested, or at least to be invested longer in the season, because we've seen cases now of teams turning their seasons around and going from almost worst to first within a season?
Yeah, I think that's one good takeaway from this is that, like, you, I mean, it's also, there's multi-factors like we talked about already, like, you know, the product of the division. If they were in, say, maybe the American League East, it'd probably be a different story if you're under 500 at the trade deadline. I mean, the top three teams won 90 games, and one of them didn't even make the playoffs in the Toronto Blue Jays. So, I mean, it's a product there, a division too, but also just I think the commitment, of the GM and Alex Anthopoulos and ownership to actually still go for it. I think, you know, they added $10 million of payroll at the trade deadline to go get those players. So it was a commitment by them to do this. And, you know, they weren't like a terrible team the first 4 months. They were playing like one. But they had talent. They have really talented players. I mean, Freddie Freeman is an all-star. He's a very, very, very good player. Ozzie Albies, Austin Riley. Like, it's not as if they were, you know, playing, you know, over their skis and, like, the team maybe didn't believe in them or, you know, vice versa, and they were underperforming. So I think it was obvious that they were due for a correction with a little bit of help. So, yeah, but I do think it sends a message where, like, maybe other teams, you know, I think there were other teams were surprised in talking to the Braves at the trade deadline that they weren't selling. But their GM Anthopoulos was willing to go for it. He believed in them. Look, he looked at their run differential. You know, they scored more runs than they allowed and saw it was still good. And so their win-loss record would adjust eventually. So, yes, I think maybe that's something to be taken away where another team in maybe a middling division cannot punt on the season and still go for it.
Talking with James Wagner of the New York Times, who was there covering the World Series. You can read all his work online. In fact, you know, people will focus on those moves made at the trade deadline, bringing in Soler and Jock Peterson before that and this guy and that guy. But you had an interesting article last week for the New York Times about maybe a bigger addition for the Atlanta Braves, and that was the soft serve ice cream machine. Tell me about this. Why was this so important?
So, you know, in a 162-game season over 6 months, that's not including spring training, which is another 2 months, and the postseason is another month. So 9 months of grinding every single day. It's a kind of about the little pleasures in life. And, you know, they were struggling in May. Then late May, they were in Boston visiting the Red Sox at Fenway Park. And then there was a three-hour rain delay. There was a soft-serve ice cream machine in the visitors' clubhouse. And so they, for the next 3 hours, they wore out that ice cream machine. And they loved it. Like, they fell in love with soft-serve then. I guess so they started asking their own home clubhouse attendant to get them one. So eventually they get one around, like June. And then this team starts taking off. They start playing better in June and July, too, and then into August, and then so on. So part of it, I think, was just, like, livening up the mood of a team that was not playing well. And a lot of people, you know, obviously jokingly, you know, think that that really made a difference. Obviously, good players make a difference. The addition of Soler, Eddie Rosario, the ones you guys you've mentioned, other ones playing better, like Freddie Freeman. But they all kind of believe that that added to the, you know, the energy, positive environment of their clubhouse the rest of the way. And also, I think it just showed, again, that they had to ask the GM, Alex Anthopoulos, for approval. You know, he didn't originally want to because, you know, nutritionists might not like that they have such a readily available source of sugar because they're supposed to be taking care of themselves. And this is, of course, the GM of the team approving to have ice cream put in there so readily. But, you know, he saw it as kind of like a partnership between them, like they're responsible adults. And just why not liven the mood? And they all, even after game six in Houston, you know, chatting with a few players post-game, two of them that were quoted in that story jokingly again told me that the ice cream machine made the biggest difference of the year.
Yeah, so, and you can read this article at the NewYorkTimes.com. We need to send this over to McDonald's to show them how important it is to have functioning ice cream machines. Those machines never work. You need ice cream in your life. But along those same lines, with that said, it kind of goes hand-in-hand with the moves that were made with the players where, and I know the guys came over, Rosario, Soler, they turned things around. They played better the second half of the season with the Braves and the teams they were at previously. But it wasn't like they went out and added, say, a Freddie Freeman, like an MVP player. They added kind of these role guys that fit their roles perfectly with the Braves. And I think the ice cream machine, as you were laying out, goes along with that about that clubhouse culture, that you bring in Jack Peterson with those pearls, and you bring in these guys that help turn around maybe the vibe in that locker room. And as you alluded to, over the course of a long baseball season, I think that can be very important. So to me, when I look at what the Braves did at the midway point, that makes it almost more impressive that it wasn't that they just went out and got the best players available, but they got these guys that seem to be good fits and turn around maybe the culture or just the little things of that team and start playing better the second half of the year.
Yeah, and Jock Peterson won a World Series with the LA Dodgers last year, so he kind of knew what it takes. He knew what it takes to get this far and to win. Adam Duvall was with the team last year and the year before, so they knew him, and he's a kind of proven run producer. But Peterson, Rosario, and Soler were not playing well with their respective teams at the time when they traded for them. I think, you know, what Anthopoulos was banking on was kind of like the regression. They were underperforming, and they would regress more. They would improve more towards their average, their career averages, as they did when they got to Atlanta. And Rosario, if you remember, was injured at the time. So when they traded for him, they didn't get him on the field immediately. So adding four guys, not to platoon per se, but almost to, like, yeah, rotate them around the three positions in the outfield was almost, he thought, a better way to fill those gaps than going all in on one bigger player. And it proved useful because then you give and you protect yourself against future injuries as well. And so adding four guys in that sense made more sense than adding just one big star player.
We'll let you get out of here on this one. Talking with James Wagner from the New York Times, who covers baseball, was there for the World Series. You know, people going into this World Series were saying that for the Astros, this was a chance to kind of vindicate themselves from what happened in 2017. A chance to prove something. I thought this did prove something, but it was the opposite. That when you look at the last two World Series, they've lost both 1-6 and home games in the World Series, averaging fewer than 3 runs per game in those 7 games. In fact, they scored as many runs in the 2017 World Series at home as they have in the home games, the two World Series since. For you, not to put words in your mouth, just that's where I stand. Mm-hmm. Did you take away anything this World Series relating to 2017 with the Astros, or do you look at this all separately?
I would say, I'm going to give you both answers because it's so hard to judge. I mean, without knowing exactly how much they used the trash can, the illegal sign stealing system in 2017, we'll never really know. I mean, they insist, and so did the commissioner's report say, they didn't use it very much in the postseason. It was too hard to use. It just makes you wonder and think that they didn't really need it then. Like, they were a good enough team then probably to win the World Series without the trash cans. I mean, I think the inverse. But then also, I mean, reaching, you know, 3 World Series in 5 years, I mean, it just shows you how talented that core group of infielders is, and Michael Brantley, I guess, recently too, and Kyle Tucker. But just how good Altuve, Correa, Gurriel, and Bregman are. Those guys are really 4 really, really incredible hitters, and it made a difference, and it helped get them this far. Maybe they didn't need the draft cans back then. And just Yeah, they still hit this postseason up until the World Series, showed how underrated the Braves pitching staff, especially their bullpen, was to shut down the Astros. Like, they're the best offense in baseball to get completely shut down like that in the World Series. So in some ways, yes, I think it does show that they're good without that. But it also, if you think about it this way, the only title they've won in these 5 years was the one that's tainted. So, I mean, what does that say about them?
Right, exactly. It could have been, for all we know, could have been the difference. Who knows? He's James Wagner, writes for the New York Times, covering baseball. Go read his work and his peers at the New York Times. They've been all over the Braves World Series. Find it online, newyorktimes.com. James, appreciate all the time, the insight. Go catch a nap and enjoy the offseason.
Take care, guys. Thank you for having me, and be safe.
Yeah, likewise. Appreciate it. James Wagner of the New York Times, who was there throughout the World Series. Yeah, for the Astros, it's not to take – you still have to – I mean, they made the World Series two times since the cheating scandal. But my point has been all along that maybe that's what made up the difference. Because remember, 2017, to remind you once again, it went seven games. And then they've lost the two World Series since. So maybe it was the trash cans that made that small of a difference, that you go from losing in potentially six games to winning in seven. Makes that small of a difference. And yes, they're a good enough team to make it to the World Series, but would they have been good enough without that advantage to win the World Series? Questions that we'll probably never have the answers to. But as James said at the very end, you look back, it doesn't look great that the one World Series victory you have is the one that you were cheating during. And that kind of makes it look even worse, right? That proves the point of people like me who are very upset at what happened. If you went out and you won the next three World Series doing it cleanly, it's like, oh, okay, well then, you know, they were a really good team. But for all we know, looking back for the data that we have, the difference for the Astros, right? The 1 year that they actually won was the year they cheated. Otherwise, they haven't had much success or as much success in the World Series. Anyways, we'll wrap up hour one when we come back. Now that the Braves can enjoy their first World Series in more than a quarter century, which fan bases are next in line needing a championship? It's the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Well, if I could walk on water, and if I could find some way to prove, if I could walk on water, would you believe in me? My love is so true.
It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Appreciate the time. Last segment from James Wagner of the New York Times joining us to talk about the World Series. If you ever miss anything from the show, catch it on demand. Just search ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. It's funny. We've talked about this on the show before, but my buddies in a group chat sent over this article this morning. Let me find where this was from, because it's all based off of like a podcast, The Washington Post, about a new podcast that revisits the rumor about Cal Ripken, Kevin Costner, and that mysterious power outage that continued Ripken's consecutive starts streak. And one of my friends sent that in a group chat this morning and said, oh, this is the first I'm ever hearing about this. You guys know about this? And I don't think any of my buddies were familiar with the story. I've shared multiple times before here on the air, and we've even had callers about it. But I'll say it again. I know two people in the Orioles organization and one who was there that night who have confirmed to me, and did it years ago, that that was, in fact, they couldn't tell me about the Kevin Costner thing, but that there was, in fact, an intentional power outage done by the Orioles to keep the streak alive. In case you're unfamiliar with the rumor or what exactly I'm talking about, Cal Ripken had that consecutive starts streak, but there was one night they had to postpone the game because of a bank of the lights wasn't working. And the rumor is that Ripken found his wife in bed with Kevin Costner and got into a fight with him, and the whole thing delayed. He couldn't get to the ballpark. Or I think maybe even part of the rumor is that people believe like he had a black eye and so he didn't want to show up to the ballpark that night and have to explain it. But just, you know, he had things going on in his own personal life, couldn't make it to the game, and so the Orioles had to come up with something. They didn't want to play the game without Cal and end his streak like that. So they said, lights aren't working. We can't play the game tonight. We'll have to play tomorrow. And then Ripken was in the lineup the next day. I can't confirm the Costner thing. I don't know about that. In fact, I tend to believe it's not true because I feel like those two people would know it. They said I don't know. I don't know about that part. I feel like they would know if that was the case. Maybe not. But they said, oh, yeah, we were there. It was intentional. So much so that when one was telling me the story, the other came in and told him to shut up, right? Like it's still like a mafia secret. Like I'm going to get whacked now that I know the story. And in this article from the Washington Post, they said the whole podcast started because one of the people of the podcast was talking to a cop who said that, yeah, it is true. And when I told this story before, we had a listener call in and say, yeah, I talked with a cop that night. I know a cop who worked there that night who said it's true. This may be the same guy. All comes full circle. A podcast started on all this because of the same guy that apparently through a second source passed along the information to the Mara Midday Show as well. Anyways, coming up later on, which fan base deserves the next championship now that the Braves have theirs? And when we come back, some thoughts on Aaron Rodgers. It's the Mara Midday Show on ESPN Radio.